Welcome to the Big Money Questions. I'm Rachel Rickard-Strauss, Personal Finance Editor at This Is Money. Today we are talking about Messy. It's a new book by Tim Harford, who we're lucky enough to have here with us today. He's the Financial Times' undercover economist, and he's also the presenter of More or Less on Radio 4, but most importantly for us, he's just written a book on why mess is good. We almost fetishize the idea of order and being sort of planning things in advance. And Tim has dedicated a whole book to looking at different areas of life in which this may not necessarily be the case. So, Tim, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And talking us through it. Can I ask you, first of all, what's so good about mess?
Well, there's a time and a place for everything, including mess. So I think that we tend to enjoy all kinds of tidiness. So we like clean desks, we feel proud of clean desks, we feel that we have to make excuses if things are a mess. It's not a compliment to call things a mess. But also we like to prepare. So if we're giving a presentation, get the PowerPoint slides out, put the bullet points down, even though we kind of know that's not making the speech better, we would still do it. We like systems, we like targets, things need to be quantified. We like to hang around with people who look like us and who think like us. So in all of these ways, we're trying to control the world around us. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's great. Sometimes that works perfectly well. I'm really glad that all the electrical sockets in the country are the same as each other, rather than random sizes and voltages. But we take it too far. So we apply this carefully prepared, quantified, controlled approach, even when actually if we let go, we're a bit more relaxed, a bit less worried about how things looked, we'd actually get more done, be more productive, be more creative.
So let's go back to the beginning with the examples you just gave. Desk. How can it be that a more disordered desk makes us more productive?
Well, we have to think about the desk as being quite a dynamic object. So those people who are fans of Marie Kondo and the life-changing magic of tidying up, which I actually am, will know that they should choose a place for everything and put everything in its place, and every object in your house you should take into your hands and reflect as to, does it spark joy? Is this what I really want in my life? And it's a once-and-for-all process. Totally fine. In your kitchen, fine. You know, put your corkscrew in the corkscrew place, put the glasses in the glasses place. The desk is a different problem. So there's new information coming across your desk every day. Emails, digital documents, magazines, books, they're always coming in. And this idea that you should just reflect about the right place to put them and put them in that place is curiously static. There is no right place to put an email. There's no correct folder structure to put any of this stuff. It doesn't have a place. We don't know where it belongs until we've actually let it sit in our inbox or on our desk for a little while to understand it. And there's some great studies of people who have messy desks. They tend to be highly effective people because actually the inflow of information is messy, and actually letting your desk is this kind of organic sorting mechanism where you sort of figure out where everything belongs and what belongs in the bin and what belongs in the filing cabinet and what needs to be acted upon. People who file everything away, everything looks tidy, but actually they don't really know where anything is, so they run into problems.
So these tidy, organised people who until now I've pretty much looked up to, the ones who have folders in their inbox and nothing on their desk, what is the fallout for them doing this? What could they be missing on?
So if they are accountants, no problem. Mm-hmm. And I'm not being snide about accountants or making some comment about the personality of the accountants, and some other professions have very structured inflows of information. Mm-hmm. So you've got your expenses, your taxes, these things are coming in, you know where they belong, and you put them in the right place, and you should do that. But for a lot of people, everything's a bit more ambiguous. It's not clear where things belong. If you try to impose order on things that actually don't have an order, you will lose them. You lose track of what's going on. And there are broader problems about being innovative, being creative. When we are distracted by random things, when we're forced to deal with situations that may at first seem like they're not optimal, they're not perfect. We feel frustrated, we feel anxious, and then very often we actually pull out a better idea, a better solution. There's lots of fascinating work, both from psychology and from computer science, as to why this happens. Mm-hmm. So the tidy people, they're not efficient in the sort of the straightforward way of knowing where all their stuff is, but they may also be missing out on creative inspiration that comes from this sort of confusion.
Let's zoom out then from inbox and desk a bit further. Even in the workplace, who you end up working with, can you apply the same kind of logic. Is that fair?
Yeah, and there's nothing more disruptive than someone who thinks differently to you, who has a different perspective, sees things in a different way. And so we very naturally seek out people like us. We sort of know we shouldn't, but we do. Mm-hmm. People who look like us, similar age, similar ethnicity, out similar training, maybe similar hobbies. Oh, you'll fit right in here, we say. We seek out our friends at networking events. We don't seek out new people and broaden our horizons. But there's lots and lots of very convincing research that says, in most cases, you actually want the awkwardness of dealing with people who think differently. Of course, there's an ethical case for diversity, but this is a really practical case. If you've got, say, 5 Londoners in a room, and you add 1 Parisian, mm-hmm. or 1 Glaswegian, for that matter, that person is going to see something the Londoners don't see. 5 men in a room, add a woman, she will see something the men don't see. And so 5 economists in a room, and you add a statistician or a sociologist. I mean, it sounds like the punchline to a terrible joke, but that those diverse perspectives make us collectively smarter. We find solutions we wouldn't have found otherwise. But we tend to feel very uncomfortable with this. And so there's some amazing research finding that even when you've got a group that has solved a problem thanks to the input of a diverse team member, afterwards, when psychologists say, well, how did you feel about that process? People will say, oh, no, it was very uncomfortable, didn't like that. Do you think you solved the problem? No, I don't think so. So the people who were assisted by this strange person in solving the problem then denied that the problem had been solved. So it's quite a deep challenge for us to get outside our comfort zones.
And I suppose some people would want to weigh up whether it's worth it. If you are going to be more comfortable and feel like you've done better, perhaps that sort of, has a place in that equation as well.
Let's hear it for complacency. it's a very comfortable place. But we do often need to be forced into these situations. It's true. That I actually begin the book with the story of the great jazz pianist Keith Jarrett showing up to play a concert in Cologne and finding that due to a mix-up, it just had an unplayable piano. The keys were sticking, it was out of tune, it was too quiet. Completely useless instrument. But that was the only choice he had. Either refuse to play or try. And he felt he had to try. And he produced the most successful piano album in history. Because it turns out that when you're brilliant like Keith Jarrett and when you're given that challenge, you pull something out of the bag. All the adaptations and adjustments he had to make to cope with this piano made the music better. He never thought to himself, great, terrible piano, this is just my opportunity to deliver a perfect piece of work. He thought, well, this is going to be a disaster.
I wonder whether it makes a difference, actually, whether you are conscious of it or not. I've noticed, I read your book a few days ago, the thought that the kind of chaos actually might be beneficial makes it feel less chaotic. It sort of calms you down a bit, knowing that actually it's all probably going to work out for the better.
Yes, and I think it does lead to quite a constructive approach. So I remember just after the Brexit vote, just after Theresa May became Prime Minister, the first thing she briefed her ministers to do was go away and find opportunities in this, which I thought was a very interesting approach. It's clearly very controversial, a lot of people very happy, a lot of people very unhappy, and her approach was find me the opportunities. And I often find that whenever I'm faced with a confusing situation now, having written the book, I'm looking for, well, this feels like Keith Jarrett's piano, the keys are sticking, things aren't working, but what might come of this? And it makes me feel better, but also, of course, you do then find ways to make lemonade from the lemons.
It must be nice as well to know that you're in good company in that sense. And also with the other musician you mentioned is Brian Eno, and his annoying cards.
Very annoying.
Tell us about those.
So he does this deliberately. Eno was one of the great figures in British music, ambient composer, produced great albums in his own right, but also worked with U2 on Achtung Baby. He worked with Coldplay. Most famously, he worked with David Bowie on three of his great albums that were produced in Berlin, Lodger, Heroes, and Low. And Eno makes a virtue of this. So he, for him, he wants to disrupt the creative processes of the musicians he's working with. He wants them outside their comfort zones. Because he says, the thing is about when I challenge people with some stupid task, he has these cards with crazy ideas on, like, just swap instruments, or take out the best bit. And just, they drive the musicians crazy. But he says, then you really pay attention. When you are feeling so uncomfortable, then you are really interested and engaged. It's the cliche of when you're in an accident and your life flashes before your eyes. You're just paying a tremendous attention to the situation. And he's effectively manufacturing little car crashes in the studio and getting the most out of these musicians because they feel anxious, they feel threatened, they feel confused, and then they produce brilliant work because their attention is absolutely on the music.
So how can we apply the Brian Eno cards to our lives? What kind of little disruptions do you think would work in the same way?
So actually, I did this recently. I was challenged by one of my favourite economics podcasts in the States to come up with a more creative way to talk about the Nobel Prize for Economics, because it's quite technical. And so we pulled out Brian Eno's Oblique Strategies, and we started going through, pulled out some cards. And it was amazing how it raised our energy and got us focused on interesting angles. So the cards do work, and you can download an app or you can order them online. Or for a more straightforward approach, maybe it's a weekend, not sure what to do, write down six things that maybe scare you a little bit but might be kind of interesting, exciting, different things to do, maybe a new sport to try, a new place to go. Number them 1 to 6, roll the dice. So you've released a little bit of control.
Have you been doing it?
Yeah. And it's,
what have you rolled?
So the thing that really, that I tried that I loved having done, but maybe quite uncomfortable, was learning to bake sourdough. Because I'm not a kitchen person, I'm not a baker person. It feels like a waste of time. There are people who can do it better than me. But to actually go, so a good friend of mine is a baker, and I went to his bakery, and he just showed me how to do this. And of course, I'm covered in dough, and I'm like, you know, like some crazy sort of Saturday night reality TV show where everything's going wrong. But I was having new experiences, and new memories were being laid down. And that's the thing, you don't have to make it a way of life. You don't have to do this every day, and you don't have to stick to it, but just those provocations.
But would that have an impact longer term than your flowery Saturday night?
Well, I mean, one good day is worth having.
That's good enough.
But let me give you an example of something that was a more profound shift. And this wasn't a provocation from Dice, this is years ago, but I was asked if I wanted to go and move to Washington, D.C. for a couple of years. New job, new city. I just had a serious relationship. My wife and I were engaged. She wasn't my wife at the time, but you know what I mean. So, you know, we just moved in together, and suddenly it's like, do you want to move out of London? Do you want to go to America? And we talked about it, and then we said, well, this is something we need to do because it'll be such an enriching experience, even though it was frightening. Mm-hmm. And she was pregnant when we moved, so we had to cope with the American healthcare system. But what I found was, years later, when we were facing slightly frightening decisions, trying to figure out the usual thing, should we move out of London? What are we going to do about schools? All those parental concerns. We were able to say, well, hang on a minute, we've done this once before. And it was frightening, but it was great. Mm. And we had some great times. And so we can do it again. So sometimes that experience of having tested yourself and frightened yourself a little bit, you can hold it with you years later.
I want to ask you about a much smaller scale, but you give an example of commuters and how they end up with a disruption that works out for the best as well.
Yes, so a few years ago, there was a tube strike in London, and about two-thirds of the underground stations were closed, and some of the lines were closed. But Londoners could still get to work on the bus, they could use overground trains, or they could try and use the tube stations that were still open. So what some researchers did was to get hold of the data from the Oyster card system, which basically lets you track everyone around all the different public transport in London. And what they found was they could identify regular commuters who took the same trip every day and then had to change because of the tube strike. Nothing surprising about that. What they found was thousands and thousands of them stayed with the new commute after the tube strike ended. If you think about commuters, surely if there's anybody who's really got his or her route to work just perfectly down, it's commuters. You do it every single day. Mm-hmm. But no, there were lots of people who were forced to try something different because of the tube strike. They didn't like it, obviously. And then suddenly they realized, oh, hang on, there's a better way to get to work. I might have been commuting this way for years and years and years, and I never knew because I didn't try this alternative. So sometimes these shocks can very quickly deliver some new solution, some better way of doing things that we just never realized.
I love that example because there are some things that we know probably there might be space for doing it in a better way, or perhaps we're not optimizing it, but you would really think your commute would be your one kind of solid certainty, you know how to commute. So it just makes you wonder whether absolutely everything ought to be questioned.
I think so. I mean, of course, most people the commutes weren't improved by the strike, and most people went back to their old ways because mm-hmm. their old ways were better. But still, you know, it was just a 2-day strike, and you might have got 10 years worth of 20 years worth of better commuting to work out of just that very, very short disruption. So it is worth trying different things.
You applied this as well to regulating banking.
Yes.
How on earth do you apply your messy principle to banking reform?
So the challenge here for regulators in general is that the stuff that we regulate is complicated. Hospitals are complicated. Banks are complicated. And it's tempting to say, right, well, because it's so complicated, there are lots and lots of things that we have to check. What that tends to lead to is very shallow and predictable tick box exercises mm-hmm. where the hospital or the bank or whatever that's being regulated knows what's coming, is able to satisfy the requirements of the regulator. Nothing's really improved. And the regulator may know that, but at least the regulator can say, well, we followed all our principles. So everyone's safe. What you really need is a much less predictable but deeper examination. So Andy Haldane at the Bank of England says this is what he would like to see, but it's difficult to do. He said, I don't want an army of regulators. I want a SWAT team. Mm-hmm. I want to go in there with a few people and ask really, really tough and unpredictable questions and really drill deep. And then you'll actually learn something about whether this is a bank that's well run. And I think a really interesting example of how things had got bad was the American regulators, the Federal Reserve, discovered that banks had been buying insurance that specifically paid off in scenarios that the regulators were testing, very predictable scenarios. So the regulator would say, well, if the dollar falls 20% and housing falls 15% and interest rates rise to 5%, how does the bank look? And the bank would be able to say perfectly truthfully, we're absolutely fine in that scenario because they've bought an insurance product that covers them against exactly that. And there's a strange parallel. It's just like VW with the emissions tests. The emissions tests were very stringent. They were tough, but they were incredibly predictable. And so VW just engineered a hack around them. And in the case of VW seems to have basically broken the law, whereas what the banks did was legal. So more unpredictable tests are actually stronger tests. They're better tests.
It seems so obvious, doesn't it, that you don't give away both what the exam paper is, what the answers are, and when the examiner's going to be there.
Sure.
You would never do that in an academic situation, except for Ofsted, which seems to think that that's an okay way to do it. But to have all the answers doesn't seem to make sense at all.
Yeah, it's tricky. We think it's obvious in exams, but of course with exams you still get controversy when people say, well, that wasn't the question, that wasn't the kind of question we were expecting, or that question was unfair. So there is a backlash against exam boards because what they did was too unpredictable or too off the wall, mm-hmm. and they have to justify what they did. So it's always tricky. A regulator can't just be law unto themselves. There have to be some boundaries. Otherwise, they can just assert a reign of terror. But I think that we could push a little bit closer towards the unpredictability of Andy Haldane's SWAT teams and make regulations less onerous, but also more robust by making them more random.
Tim, can I ask you finally why you wrote the book? Why did you feel the need to stand up for messy?
Well, it was originally a book about silos, about the way that we wall ourselves off into particular academic disciplines or tribes of people who think exactly like us. And why do we like that? And why aren't we willing to talk to different people? But of course, in a very messy way, it grew and grew and grew into just a celebration of all that's unplanned and all that's random. And I kept coming across stories that I felt I had to tell. And maybe the one that sticks with me the most is young Martin Luther King preparing every single word of his sermons, 15 hours for each Sunday sermon, and they were good. Mm-hmm. But then when he was forced into the middle of the Montgomery bus boycott, he's got a baby daughter, he's not sleeping, he's under pressure, the TV crews are there, the newspapers are there, huge audiences, and he's just got a few minutes to prepare his speech. So he prays, writes down a few notes, and he goes to give his speech. And it is the greatest speech he's ever given in his life. And people who've seen him speak every Sunday say they never thought Martin Luther King could speak with that force. So sometimes when we let go of our preparation, when we let go of our systems, and we're willing to expose ourselves to much riskier situations, we discover who we really are. It's what makes us human.
Mm-hmm. Although it sounds like it's still a bit of both. He was an incredible speaker because he'd been practicing and preparing speeches for 15 hours until then. And the pianist was already an extraordinary pianist.
He was a great pianist, absolutely. But it's still... But, I mean, all of us have... great skills in us. Mm-hmm. Just the ability to hold a conversation. Robots can't do this. Mm-hmm. Toddlers can't do this. Grown-up human beings can do this. And yet we still often wall ourselves off from conversation. Increasingly people are resorting to email, to text, because it's safer. It's more controllable. You can edit what you say. It's not real time. So I think you don't have to be a Martin Luther King or a Keith Jarrett to enjoy spontaneity, but also to find that spontaneity a little bit threatening.
Mm-hmm. It's a good message. Thank you so much, Tim, for joining us. Thank you very much for joining us on the Big Money Questions.